Chapter 12, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives a promise somewhere in there. I don't remember the exact verse, but basically Krishna says, I am the swift deliverer. That's the phrase he uses in the 12th chapter. I am the swift deliverer of a living entity from repeated birth and death.
It's 5 or 6.
Text 5 or 6. I'm going to pull that up real quick. Oh, this edition needs help. Yes, 6 and 7. But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, being devoted to me without deviation, engaged in devotional service, and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Preta, for them I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. That actually gives us a clue into what's coming in the 13th chapter, that particular verse. We talked about, this was in a Bhagavatam class a few days ago, we talked about the Bhagavad Gita, how it's divided into 3 sections. The first 6 chapters, the second 6 chapters, and oh, thank you. You're a godsend. First 6 chapters, the second 6 chapters, and the third 6 chapters. The first 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita deal with basically understanding that there's a spiritual reality. A living entity, it's a spirit being. Some of the different qualities of the living entity. That's the first 6 chapters. The last 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita talks about, Krishna talks about how the living entity actually interacts with the modes of material nature, different aspects of material nature, living entities, and so on and so forth. It gets a little more detailed on the relationship between the living entity and the modes of nature. In the middle 6 chapters of Bhagavad Gita is where Krishna actually talks about devotional service the most, bhakti yoga. Where he begins to, and at first I don't think we find the word bhakti until the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna describes, he says karma yoga, he says akarma, but he doesn't say bhakti until like the seventh or eighth chapter of the Gita. It's right smack almost in the middle of the Gita. Prabhupada describes that the first 6 chapters and the last six chapters are like two breads of a sandwich that keep the, I won't say the meat of the sandwich, but the right, it doesn't work, does it? The cheese. The cheese and the tofu burger in the center. And the two sides are sandwiching that the essence, that's what Prabhupada used, the essence of Bhagavad Gita comes in the middle six chapters. What is also very important, this is a bit of an aside, but we talked about the three categories of spiritual knowledge, Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Sambandha is the first category. Sambandha means relationships. What is a relationship? Back up a little bit more. The Bhagavad Gita has five basic subject matters that are talked about in the Bhagavad Gita. The living entity, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, matter, that we see around us, time, because we exist in the time factor, and activities. These five subject matters are taught in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna addresses these things. Now, Sambandha is the understanding of how all these five things work together. How does the living entity, the individual living entity, relate to the Supreme? How does the living entity relate with karma? How does karma relate with the Supreme Personality of God? How does the Supreme Personality of God relate with Prakriti? All the relationship between these five subject matters, that's Sambandha. Prayojana is the, second category of knowledge, is what's the process, now that we know all the relationships between these five subject matters, what's the spiritual process that will bring us from, elevate us out of the material conditioning and understanding into the spiritual realm? What's the process? And Krishna brings up many processes, different types of yoga. These are all different processes to elevate us spiritually. So we have the first category of knowledge is Sambandha, just understanding the different relationships. Then the second category of knowledge is a process. What's the process by which we can move forward in our devotional life, in our spiritual life? Not devotional, spiritual life. Prayojana is the understanding of the category of knowledge, that third category of knowledge, which deals with the result. What is the result of our spiritual practice? The result of all spiritual practice is to become linked with the Supreme. We can be linked through the Supreme on three levels. Through Brahman, merging into the Supreme effulgence, that's one way of being linked. Second way of being linked is through Paramatma, which means that meditation and being fully absorbed in meditating on the form of the Lord. That's the second way of being linked. The third way of being linked is Bhagavan realization. We actually have a relationship with Krishna, like Yashoda and Krishna. But the goal of all spiritual processes is to be linked. That's why they're all called yoga, Sankhya yoga, Karma yoga, Ashtanga yoga, Dhyana yoga. They're all called yoga because the goal is linking. So the goal of all knowledge, third category is Prayojana, is to link. Abhideya, the second category, is how do you get that connection? How do you get to the goal? What process do you use to get to that goal? The reason why I'm going into all that is because we see in the 12th chapter, Krishna says, I am the swift deliverer from material nations. In the 13th chapter, that's what Krishna really talks about, this material nations. We'll see when we go into, we're reading the 13th chapter this week. When we begin reading the 13th chapter, Krishna will begin to pull apart the different material nature. He will explain the living entity in relationship to material nature, the Supreme Personality of God in relation to material nature. He'll really get into the knowledge, the understanding of he makes a promise in chapter 12. In chapter 2, he gives the knowledge by which that actually happens. He tells how it happens, how he delivers the living entity from the ocean of birth and death with a particular type of knowledge. That is knowledge of the Supreme, knowledge of how the living entity can come out of material nature. That's given in the 13th chapter. We'll see, just to go a little bit ahead, in the 14th chapter, Krishna will become even more specific and talk about how the best of all this knowledge is devotional service and where that ends up. So the 13th chapter deals primarily with Krishna addressing this promise, I am the swift deliverer, that he gives in the 12th chapter. He's giving this knowledge by which the living entity can become delivered from the nations of birth and death. What is also important is the knowledge to be delivered from birth and death is not the same as being all-knowing. Krishna does not tell Arjuna, Krishna does not even begin to explain the details of how the material nature works. The knowledge Krishna is giving, it's about how to become free from modes of material nature. That's what comes up in the 14th chapter. Krishna, in the 13th chapter, Krishna talks about the modes of material nature and everything. In the 14th chapter, Krishna tells their influence and how to get out of it. Again, coming from that promise of the swift deliverer in the 12th chapter. What was my point? Knowledge. Krishna gives the knowledge. He's not going to waste his time explaining to Arjuna the details of the spiritual world. Krishna does not waste his time explaining to Arjuna the intricacies of the detailed intricacies of spiritual reality. He doesn't even waste his time explaining Arjuna the details of material nature. And then we know, even in our own lives, there's so much difficulty. I mean, Satya is a scientist. He can tell you how difficult it is just trying to understand material nature. What to speak of the vast knowledge contained in spiritual reality, how the spiritual energies work, and so on and so forth. It's very, very complex. The example is given of trying to explain to a blind person the color green. It's a concept in the in our conditioned state. We will never understand fully spiritual nature. We have a hard enough time with material nature. What to speak of spiritual nature? So the example is given of trying to explain to a blind person the color green. Someone who's never had eyesight, and you try to explain to them what green looks like. And the person says, well, does it taste like an apple? No. Does it feel rough? No, it's green is very cooling. Oh, so it's like ice. No, it's not like ice. So they're trying to understand the color green without having the ability, the instruments, to even if they had green, they would not understand it. If it's sitting right, they have something green in their hand, they wouldn't understand it because they don't have the necessary instruments to understand it. So my point is that Krishna does not give knowledge which the conditioned living entity is not going to understand to begin with. There are some things in our conditioned state we are not going to understand. It's just as simple as that. Because we are blind, we're not going to understand the color green. The knowledge Krishna gives is knowledge how to get out of material nature. That's it. Krishna does not go into details of how this is working. I mean, some of it's there, and some of it's mind-boggling. Even a little bit that he gives is mind-boggling. But Krishna, knowledge that Krishna gives is about how to get out of material nature, how to progress from being conditioned to being liberated, to being purified. That's all the knowledge that Krishna gives. Even in the Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and all of the scriptures, the primary goal of all of knowledge given in the scriptures is how to get out of material nature. It's actually twofold. One is how to live happily in material nature, and that's jnana, karma kanda. Another part is how to attain liberation, which is the jnana kanda. And the third level is upasana kanda. Forgive me about the Sanskrit, I'm just giving you a basic understanding of what the Vedas, scriptures are all about. Upasana kanda really describes, and the upasana kanda is the smallest part of the Vedas, which talks about how to have a relationship with Krishna. Upasana really means, literally means to sit nearby. Asana means to sit, upasana means in proximity. Upasana means how to come closer to be in a relationship with Krishna. That's the smallest part of the Vedas. So, point being is that the knowledge contained in the Bhagavad Gita and elsewhere is really just to get us out of material nature, to give us eyesight. Once we have eyesight, there's no need to explain the color green. That's why we'll come across verses where Krishna says, once you know this, there'll be nothing further you need to know. That means once Arjuna has understanding, once he has the ability to perceive green, there's no need to write a book on the color green. Only people who don't have eyesight do you have to write a treatise on so that they try to understand green. And it'd be very, very difficult. When a person has eyesight, there's no need to write a book. There's no need to have classes. There's no need to have a degree course in the color green. You have eyesight, you understand it. It's the same thing as spiritual nature. Once we are purified and have that liberation, we are granted the eyesight necessary to see everything in the spiritual realm and understand everything in the spiritual realm. Last Sunday, one of the after the class, the Sunday lecture, one of Mataji came to me and asked a question on how do we get Krishna prema. The question was a little more involved than that, but that was the gist of it. And there's nothing we can do, because Krishna prema is not something we can go out and buy. It's not something we can build. Krishna prema is actually something that Krishna gives to us. And we know, because as reading the 10th chapter, we know that Krishna says, I give the understanding by which you can come to me. It's not something we can, the only thing we can do is desire. When we desire fully, completely, then Krishna gives us the understanding, he gives us the eyesight. And then we see green. We cannot go out and try to get the eyesight. We cannot go out and try to perceive the color green. The ability to see green, or spiritual reality, is given by Krishna when we have that full, intense desire. So the knowledge given in the Bhagavad Gita is about how to get out of the material realm, the material conditioning, beyond the conditioning of the three modes of material nature. That's the substance of the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita. Once we're out of the material, beyond the modes of material nature, then we see full spiritual reality, complete spiritual understanding. That's where the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita goes, leads to. So the 13th chapter is dealing about this particular, is addressing this promise Krishna gives in the 12th chapter about he is a swift deliverer. The 13th chapter gets into more detail of what is that knowledge that gives deliverance. And it is that knowledge Krishna talks about in the 13th chapter, the Purusha, the enjoyer, the soul, Prakriti, all these different aspects. Once we know that, we understand we're not. And knowing means, we were talking about this yesterday, there's Gyan and there's Vigyan. There's knowing on a theoretical level, and then there's Vigyan, there's realization. When Krishna talks about knowing, he's always talking about realization. It's easy to read something in a book. But realization is far beyond just reading, having theoretical understanding. So the 13th chapter is all knowledge based on what Krishna is describing or dealing with that promise of being the swift. What is the knowledge required in order for us to become swiftly, expediently delivered from the modes of material nature? And then in the 14th chapter, as we'll see, Krishna goes into more detail about the, to put it differently, Krishna promises in the 12th chapter. In the 13th chapter, he talks about the knowledge needed to get out of material nature. In the 14th chapter, Krishna talks about material nature, the modes of material nature. He goes into detail of the modes of material nature. So we see in these three chapters, there's a promise given, I'm a swift deliverer from the modes of material nature, Neshans. In the 13th chapter, we see all the knowledge involved for us to get that deliverance. And then in the 14th chapter, Krishna describes this, the trap of material nature, the details of that trap, how conditioning it is, how it conditions us, in so many different ways it conditions us, and how to get out of it later on. So that's what will be coming up this week in the 13th chapter. Anything to discuss, to share? Questions? Yes?
So the three modes of material nature, is it, I believe it's part of the jivatma, or maybe it's part of the senses?
Material nature is before the senses, because material nature comes from prakriti. Prakriti, we don't want to go into the whole Vedic creationism because that gets quite involved. But before we have material senses, our material senses come from prakriti. Prakriti is material nature that is differentiated. In the process of creation, we have material nature that does not have form, it does not have shape, it does not have color, does not have any quality. It has no variety. Then it comes to a stage where it has variety. It has form. It has shape. It becomes, that's when we have water, fire, earth. It becomes differentiated. It has variety, material nature, in so many different ways. In that stage, that's where the senses then are developed. eyes, ears, nose, touch, so on and so forth. So Prakriti is the, and that's actually talked about. It's interesting you bring that up. You're a step ahead of the game. In the 14th chapter, Krishna describes Prakriti as the mother and Krishna himself as the seed-giving father. So Prakriti is the mother, and then Krishna impregnates, if you will, Prakriti, and that's where we get all the various types of living entities. Krishna puts the living entities in Prakriti, and we come out, well, in all shapes and sizes. That would be us. So the senses come after Prakriti. What was the other half of that question? Or that was the question.
Part of the mind. Is it part of the jiva?
The jiva is completely separate from Prakriti, the modes of nature, and everything. The problem with the jiva is that the jiva is conditioned by the modes of material nature.
So that's why I asked whether it's part of the jiva.
No, it's not part in the sense, it's like, think of it as a glove. If I put on a glove, the glove is part of my hand but different. Once I remove my hand from the glove is inert. The Prakriti is inert, it has no quality of its own. Once I put it on, then it acts, it does what it's got movement, it's got form, it's got quality. So in the sense that the living entity has a body, the material nature is part of the living entity. But at the time of death, the living entity is separate from the body. The body dies and living goes on to another body. We live or we exist in the material world in three ways, or on three levels. The first level of our existence is the gross physical body that you can see, touch, taste, poke, pinch, and so on. The second level of our existence in this world is on the subtle realm. That's the mind, the intelligence, and false ego. That's on the more subtle realm. The third level of our existence is our identity, who we are, spirit soul. So we have a spirit soul, and we have the subtle body, and over the subtle body we have the body of matter. So at death, the body of matter falls away, and we go on in the subtle body and the spirit soul. The spiritual, that's who we are. So at death, the spirit soul travels to the next body in a subtle body. The gross body dies, goes into the ground, or is burned. So the soul in the subtle body travels to the next body, and it gets another gross body, whatever it may be. Spiritual realization is when we drop that subtle body and we're just a pure spirit being. That's the process of any spiritual process, is how to get rid of that subtle body. The subtle body is also, it's also like a glove. The subtle body only has activity, only has quality as long as it's in connection with the spirit soul. So the subtle body is also a manifestation of Prakriti. Nice. Manifestation of the modes of material nature. All spiritual processes are to eliminate, well, it's easy. We're going to lose the gross body. That's a guarantee. Eliminating the subtle body, that's the goal of all spiritual processes. Because once we eliminate the subtle body, then we have a pure spirit being. The problem with the subtle body is that that's where ego is. We really identify, the soul identifies with that ego. We don't know how to not have the idea of I am this. So to purify the subtle body, we can come to an understanding, yes, the gross body is going to die. We can come to that fairly easily, but giving up identity in a material way is very, very, on a subtle plane, is very, very difficult. That's the process of spiritual. And then Krishna talks about that in the 14th chapter, how to, the gross body and the subtle body are material. They're both material, and they are both part of the modes of material nature. Three modes of material nature, they both can be shed. They both can be given up, like Krishna gives in the second chapter, a coat, clothing. Both gross and subtle bodies can be given up. It's just much more difficult for the subtle body. Is that all?
So how does the spirit travel if it doesn't have a form?
How does the spirit soul travel? From one body to the next, or from what to what? It doesn't need a body. A gross body slows down the spirit soul. A gross body hampers the spirit soul. The spirit soul, when traveling, two things. The spirit soul traveling from here to somewhere is actually erroneous. There is nowhere really to go. Remember, we, in the material world, we're dealing with time and space in a linear way. The only thing we understand is going from A to B. We do not understand how I can sit here and I'm in Boston. If I change my consciousness, I'll be in Chicago. That's not something we understand without time and space. We need, in our condition, prakriti mind, we need time and space to change our reality. And spiritual realm is not like that. The spiritual realm, once we are pure spirit beings, we do not need time and space to change our reality. Now that's a high level of understanding, that we can be purified right here, and that's what Prabhupada used to say, it's immediate. Change your consciousness, you're in the spiritual world. That's a very high level of understanding, A. B is, if we want to talk about time and space traveling from here to Goloka Vrindavan, there is no need. There is no need for the spirit soul to get into a conveyance to fly somewhere. It happens instantaneously. The spirit soul does not need wings. The spirit soul does not need a body at all to travel from one to one material reality, from the material universe to the spiritual world. Go on.
One more question.
Yeah.
So why does it need a subtle body?
It needs a subtle body in order to inhabit a gross body. The subtle body gets in the way when going to the spiritual world, but this living entity needs a subtle body in order to change, because in living entity needs to grasp or identify with something. That's why the subtle body stays with the living entity. She's got very good questions. The spirit soul always has the same subtle body, the same mind, the same intellect, and the same ego. This idea of I am something always travels with the conditioned living entity, always. We need that in order for this living entity to have different bodies. So let's say I want to be a great athlete. Karma adjusts my subtle body so that I can identify with the idea of being a great athlete. The material nature gives me the body of an athlete. I go through all of that, and then I have the desire to be a great scientist. So the athletic body falls away, and then the subtle body is adjusted so they have the mentality of a scientist. And then the material body comes, and I go in that. So the subtle body constantly adjusts according to the desire of the living entity. And that's why the subtle body always stays with the soul. So the subtle body is like maybe an adapter or something. It enables the living entity, the spirit soul, to identify with material nature. Because if you didn't have a subtle body, the spirit soul would not identify, couldn't identify with these dense, gross bodies. It needs ego in order to grasp. And that's interesting. This is gruesome. Forgive me, but I'm going to use the example anyways. Like an organ transplant. The body needs to be, the soul needs to be compatible with the body. Like an organ needs to be compatible to be transferred from one body to the next. The compatibility, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, you're the scientist. Blood types and things like that have to be compatible. So the subtle body is what makes the soul compatible with each body that it goes to. So the subtle body is required in order for us to inhabit the body of a demigod, to inhabit the body of an African American, to inhabit the body of an animal. So that's what we always have, and which is why it's very difficult to give up, to purify ourselves of the subtle body, because we've had the subtle body through thousands of lifetimes. So to purify and shed that subtle body is the most difficult thing to do. Anything else? No, the spiritual body does not control. Once the spiritual body, the soul has only one quality. Oh, let me rephrase that. It has three qualities. It is eternal. It is aware. It's what gives life to everything, full of knowledge. And it is blissful. It is pleasure-seeking. Those are the three qualities of the spirit, soul, of spirituality.
And does it change?
No, it does not change. But it does, the soul does, one thing only. The soul can desire. That's it. Once the soul has desired, one of two things happens. We have yoga maya and we have maha maya. We have energy of Krishna, energy of the Lord. Yoga maya is spiritual energy. Maha maya is material energy. We had a class on energies. We're not going to go down that because that's a whole nother, the different types of energy. Suffice it to say, the soul can only desire. Once the soul has desired something, depending on that desire, one of these two energies are activated. If the soul has desired something contrary to, not connected with the Supreme or Krishna, spirituality, then Mahamaya, which is material nature, acts. The example is given, once we desire to drop a brick off a building, we've done it. Then physics takes over. And whatever is going to happen is going to happen. We can desire to do it, but once the desire is done, physics, so Mahamaya are the laws of physics. Once we've desired something, Mahamaya, with our subtle body, adjusts everything, gives us a gross body, and then it starts to happen down that road. If we desire according to spiritual principles through connection with Krishna, then Yogamaya takes over. But Yogamaya is different from Mahamaya. Material nature, Mahamaya, we have no, Mahamaya controls the outcomes of everything. She is in much more control of what happens along that round, along that line. Yogamaya, her, we desire, what she does is slightly different. She does everything to help the living entity have a relationship with Krishna. So she doesn't control, she leaves the outcome to Krishna. If we want to boil milk and make sweet rice for Krishna, she gives us all the things necessary to do that. And then we take the sweet rice, we offer it to Krishna, and Krishna deals with the results, whatever that may be. So Yogamaya is a more facilitator of our service. She does whatever it takes for us to serve Krishna, have a wonderful relationship with Krishna. She helps that relationship. Mahamaya is different. She has her specific, actually her long-term goal, if you will, is to get us to understand that going down this road is a dead-end road. To get us to understand that we can go down this road, it just keeps going, going, and going. As long as we desire all these different things, all these different outcomes have variety, differences. You throw a one-pound brick, it's a different result. A two-pound brick, another result. If you throw it, a different result. If you spin it, it's a different result, according to the laws of physics. But you're still throwing a brick. So Mahamaya, the goal of Mahamaya is Mahavishnu, you've been throwing this brick in many different ways, but you've been throwing this brick 275 million times. When are you going to get it that it's just the same thing's going to happen? It's going to drop down and shatter in so many different ways. And then maybe if I choose to desire something differently, then see what happens in the spiritual realm. And that's actually where we actually have true freedom. Because Mahamaya over here, she has all the laws already written. How it's going to happen, once we've desired, it will follow a certain path once we've desired. In the spiritual realm, that's only where real freedom is, because a person who is deciding the result is Krishna. And Krishna is allowing or facilitating a result based on our relationship. So that's where freedom is. Yogamaya does not dictate how Krishna is going to react. If I give a sweet rice, hot sweet rice to Krishna, Yogamaya has no idea, does not influence how Krishna is going to react to that. That relationship is strictly between Krishna and the living entity. So that's where there's actual freedom in the spiritual realm. We know in the second chapter, Krishna says, by the regulative principles of freedom, those principles of freedom are actually in the spiritual realm. There's no real freedom in the material realm. After we've desired. In the spiritual realm, after we've desired, all kinds of variety and freedom takes place because we have no idea what that living entity's relationship with Krishna is going to bring. I can offer sweet rice, one thing may happen. Satya can offer sweet rice, something else may happen with Krishna. In a material realm, if I drop a brick, Satya can come and duplicate the exact same thing and get the exact same result. Because it's Mahamaya has everything written according to a certain pattern. The laws of material nature are set. That's why we can get repetition in the material world. There's no repetition in the spiritual world. Because it's Yoga Maya, the energy of the spiritual world, leaves the relationship alone. It's Krishna's relationship. She can't touch that relationship. So Krishna and the devotee, you never know what's going to happen in the spiritual realm. In the material realm, you know what's going to happen. If Satya can duplicate exactly the way I drop the brick, when it falls, it's going to shatter in the exact same, an exact number of pieces. If we get all the variables exactly the same, that's what science is all about, right? Duplicating results. You're a scientist too. It's duplicating results. That's material. You cannot duplicate results in the spiritual world. Only if Krishna wants. Otherwise, everything, that's where freedom is in the spiritual realm.
Does karma affect any of these two? Or rather, which one does it affect more? The Mahamaya or the
Yoga? Karma is all in Mahamaya. And that's what the laws of physics is, the laws of karma in Mahamaya. The laws of karma is what decides how everything functions. So we desire something, the laws of karma, that's Mahamaya's laws of physics, the laws of karma decide how it's going to come to pass. In Yoga Maya, the laws of karma are completely irrelevant. They don't exist. It's all what the Supreme Personality of Godhead wants. It's all what Krishna wants, all what Vishnu wants, all what Krishna wants. Karma has no business, no existence in the spiritual realm. The laws of karma are only in the material realm. And those are the laws by which everything is governed. If I want something in the material realm, then, using an example, Mahamaya goes to a book and she sees Mahavishnu, he has this desire. In order for that desire to be fulfilled, these things have to happen. In order for the brick to shatter in 2,700 pieces, it has to be dropped in a certain way. If it's dropped in water, it won't shatter. So when I desire something in the modes of material nature, the law of karma recognizes the desire and knows what needs to happen in order for that desire to be resulted. Now, I may desire something, it may take up to 7 lifetimes. That's the frightening part. It may take 7 lifetimes for it to come to pass. If I want to drop a brick and make sure it shatters in so many different pieces, again, you're a scientist. If you want a particular result, you may have to keep trying the experiment numerous times. It's the same thing in the material realm. If we want, we have a desire. I want $1 million. Mahamaya looks at what it's going to take in order for that to happen. Because we also have previous karma. I may have karma that says I cannot have $1 million for 3 lifetimes. So Mahamaya, okay, you want $1 million, you have to wait 3 lifetimes and you're able to have it in the 4th lifetime. So that's, we're going through all, we're doing experiment after experiment after experiment. The point is Mahamaya is trying to get us to understand is, the only thing you're doing is dropping a brick off a building. When are you going to leave that alone, go to real freedom, and have a relationship where there's any possibility? There's no limit to the possibilities of that relationship with Krishna. No limit. It can change in any number of variables. So karma is only, and that's another reason why, I'll have a job in a moment. Telling the future, it's not difficult. Telling the future is not a mystical ability. Telling the future, and that's why in the science of astrology, it's not an art. Astrology is not an art. Palmistry is not an art. It's a science. Because it's going according to laws. The laws of karma. Not the laws of physics, but the laws of karma. Predicting the future in the Vedic sense is actually, it's data management. That's what it actually is. In the Vedic system, the idea of predicting the future comes from the understanding that if we desire something, there's a chain of events, chain of reactions. It's going to end up a certain way. So it's not difficult. We hear and we read in the Bhagavad Gita how many wonderful sages could see the future. It's data management. If, as a scientist, we know, let's say we know all the laws of physics, and I go to a scientist and say, I'm going to drop this brick. Can you tell me how it's going to shatter? If they know, that's missile technology. Ballistic missile technology is that you know the density of the air, you know the humidity, you know everything about the laws of physics, that you know exactly where the missile is going to land. It's just data. It's all data according to set laws. In the material world, it's the same thing. If we have a particular desire, a person who knows the science of astrology, the science of palmistry, all these different predictive sciences, they can look at something and say, these are all there, these are certain desires, it's going to end up with fairly good accuracy that this is going to happen. Because it's data. It's just data that's already there. It's not something that is very difficult to grasp if you know the science, if you know have the knowledge of it. Because it's all quite predictive. It predicts itself, actually. It's just, the problem is that it's a lot of data. Because we have karma from previous lives that no one knows about. Only Maya knows about it. We have desires that are so small, we barely know about it. So it's a lot of data that we don't have access to. We don't know our previous karma. But someone who knows our previous karma, Krishna, Maya, they know our previous karma. Predicting what's going to happen is not difficult. That's why there's no freedom in the material world. For example, we see we're in this life. We've already dropped the brick. We're on the way down. So someone can look with knowledge, for example. They can see that this brick is falling like this. They know the density of the air, that the surface is going to fall on. They can predict what's going to happen when it reaches the bottom. Because we're already in the process of being a material nature. We already have something's already. We've already dropped ourselves off the building, so to speak. We have there's already so many things that are coming towards us in our future. So it's not for someone to understand who knows the science of the Mahavishnu. At this point, you're going to have to go through this issue. All they're doing is they're seeing that the brick is going to fall in water rather than in grass, rather than on cement. So, but the thing is that that's an enormous amount of knowledge. Not only Krishna knows it. We read stories about how Brahmana demigods can see past, present, and future. It's science. It's knowing that, the brick is falling, and it's falling on concrete. It's going to shatter in so many pieces.
I just want to add one little point on that. This is from Brahman Swami. Doing devotional service actually burns up a lot of karma. Not only good karma, but not only bad karma, but also good karma. So in that sense, even though the astrologers may probably predict that this might probably be going to happen and things like that, but if you're very serious about devotional service, a lot of these karmas get burned up, and then Krishna takes over. So just a point.
Krishna is the unknown variable. Once we've said Krishna, it changes everything.
Okay.
The only thing is that the most important thing is just to add a little bit of Krishna, and it changes everything. You don't have to be fully surrendered.
Not fully.
But you just add a little bit of Krishna, and it changes things. It blows the brick off course, so to speak. That's the variable that throws off all calculations. Everything else is known, but once you add Krishna, it throws off everything. Even if you add demigods, that also is predictive. Krishna says right there in the third chapter that as you worship the demigods, they're bound to serve you. That's just adding another predictive element. When you add Krishna, there is complete and total unpredictability. Because Krishna is not under the modes of material nature. Krishna is not under the laws of karma. Krishna is the only entity that's not under the laws of karma in the material world. So when Krishna acts, it changes Krishna with veto power. He can change everything. And it doesn't take full surrender. It doesn't take full surrender. That's what Prabhupada says, once you get initiated, it changes everything. Once we say, Krishna, please help me, it changes everything. When Draupadi threw her hands up, Krishna, save me, it changed everything in a way that was completely unpredictable. Sorry was coming out of the sky. It makes no sense.
That was also for some karma from previous births.
What was?
That sari, I thought like Draupadi in some births before, she had donated some like tons of saris like, as donations.
Mm-hmm.
So that particular time during Vastraharan, when she was calling to Krishna, like, just like that, Krishna didn't come. But when she put both her hands up calling Krishna, Krishna came and gave the sari. So like that, you know, like the good karma was helped her.
Well, yes. Another way of looking at it is that good karma, why wouldn't she get the sari the day before? Someone, a merchant could have came and donated her so many saris. It's just, you're
the
right, when
right
you add
time,
Krishna...
Yeah, the way you said, the calling Krishna at the right time.
Yeah, it changes everything. Because the sari could have came at a time when Dushasan wasn't there pulling on her sari. Karma has its effect, absolutely. But it is only Krishna that can change it. It is only Krishna that can change a variable in so many different ways. And we may see it, oh, it's karma. Sure, it could be. It may not be. But the thing is that when you add Krishna, that is the only variable that's not predictive. Karma is, in the material nature, in the Mahamaya realm, karma is always predictive. Yes?
I was just going to ask you, karma can do things that are magical like that, though, like the laws of
Yes and no. What we define as magic is not magical.
I'm just saying that karma itself doesn't have to adhere to the laws of what we think of as normal, does it?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think we're mixing two different...
on Earth.
I'm not understanding the question.
Can karma itself give you an unlimited soul?
Can karma itself give you an unlimited sarmi?
What is karma?
Yeah, it, I think we're...
Karma
is... Sorry?
Karma is not a demigod or...
Right.
It's the fruits of our actions.
Right, it's an energy,
yeah.
Exactly. It's not a... It's we you're describing karma as a thing that does something. Karma is just a principle by which matter functions. If Prakriti functions, fire does not spontaneously combust in water. It just doesn't in material nature. So if fire popped out of water, it wouldn't happen.
Right,
because
it would have to be Krishna. And that was what I was asking, was wouldn't it have to be Krishna if something out of the natural order happens?
Well, then it comes to Krishna and our ignorance. 1,000 years ago, if they had seen a plane flying across the sky, there was, oh, it's Krishna. But we know now it's just physics. Because we know aerodynamics. So we can send this. So just because we don't understand, oh, it looks like it's magical now, it may be that we're just not ignorant enough, or we're not knowledgeable about material nature. Maybe someone may be able to spontaneously produce fire and water. You don't know that. It may be part of material nature. So that's what I'm saying. Let's not define miracles as this or that. And as Gayatri is saying, karma is not something that, it's not a person, it's a principle. We may discover the laws of karma according to, let's put it this way. We may know 30% of all laws of karma in this stage of humanity, right? 2012. We may know 30% of prakriti, material nature. The other 70% we just haven't gotten to yet. Just like in the past, they had no idea that the surface of the globe was circular. They thought it was flat. It's just, that's ignorance. It's not because all of a sudden the world bent and became circular. It's just ignorance. So a lot of things we don't know that we may think is magical, sometimes it really may just be material nature, being material nature. We just didn't have any concept of it. But speaking to another half of your point about something that is truly spiritual, or I guess you would call magical, I hesitate to get into a magical realm of things because you're really talking about I have a problem. I don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about magical things. It could really just be nature that we're just not knowledgeable, aware of. You'd have to talk to someone else about magic and how we define magical things. And
all I meant was, it was that if something that appears magical, that's not, that's really abnormal, like an unlimited sorry comes out, one would assume that that would be an act of God rather than just a natural appearance in your karma. Just a, it could be the wrong assumption, but that would be my assumption.
But sometimes an act of God is through karma. Sometimes, you know, an act of God, you know, say, you know, I don't have a dhoti. An act of God could be someone, Satya, giving me a dhoti. That could be, God can work through. An act of God can come through karma, can be described by karma. I'm walking down the road and I find a $1 million check. It can be an act of God, but it can be literally Satya opened up his wallet and his check fell out. It can be described according to observable phenomena. So that's why I hesitate to go in something as magical. Krishna does not have to jump out of a pillar with Nisringadev in order for it to be magical.
But if he does, I would assume it wasn't just playing karma. I would assume it was Krishna.
Well, that's another thing. And that's, I think that's why we don't see it that way. We don't see those kinds of things. Imagine if he opened up the altar and then we looked at the deities and they started moving. I would freak out. I would literally, I'd run out of the temple. I think ghosts. I mean, that's why Krishna doesn't act outside of those laws, because we can't handle it. You know that famous, you can't handle the truth? If the deity started dancing on the altar, I'd have nightmares. I would have nightmares. I'm a wuss. I can't deal with that. So Krishna stays on the altar and he doesn't move because that's what I can handle. So oftentimes, Krishna does not need to manipulate matter in order for us to experience a miracle. If matter starts taking on shapes and things start popping out of walls, I mean, Prabhupada said that. That was a famous Prabhupada quote. Someone came and said, he was chanting, and said, "Oh, Prabhupada, I see stars and shining lights and shapes." And Prabhupada said, "Oh, keep chanting and it'll go away." So we're looking for things to pop out of walls. And Krishna doesn't need to have things pop out of walls in order for him to act in our life. If Krishna began popping out of walls for me, I would check myself into an insane asylum. Because I'm not ready for that. So Krishna acts in my life in very, very pedantic, very, very easily explicable ways that I can say, oh, this is that. And then it takes purification for me to recognize, well, actually, no, Krishna was protecting me in that situation. Protecting me simply means the light turned red when this thing happened. And I'll end on this story. Me and Daryl, and this is a miracle. This is a miracle for me. Me and Daryl, he'll tell you the story. He actually wrote it down. It was 3 or 4 years ago. We were walking up Boylston, and there was a scaffolding on the building on Boylston. I think it's, what's that college? Is that Emerson on Boylston? They were doing some work on the awning, on the facade, the front of the building, and there was a huge scaffolding up to the top of the building. So me and Daryl, we were walking down the that side of Boylston. It was on the opposite side of Boylston, that side of the street. We walked under the scaffolding. And as soon as we walked out from under the scaffolding, we heard a huge crash. And it was not 10 feet away. I don't swear to God, but you get my point.
We turned. People.
That's the one.
The office building down the street.
Yes, that's the one. We turned 10 feet away. It was a pile of scaffolding. And there was a car that was in the street. And it had rubble all over it. And it was so flat. And we were looking inside to see if someone was in the car. And it looked like it was so flat, you could not, it was just flattened. Apparently there was someone in the car. And it was so flat, you couldn't tell that there was a human being in the car. And I kid, asked Daryl. We it was 10 feet away. Now, we can explain that by, oh, you're 30 seconds. Yeah, you were 30 seconds ahead of time. You can explain it was just, chance. That was Krishna. To my dying day, it was just Krishna moving me and Daryl out of the way and letting it do its job. Because, I mean, it was, because that, that scaffolding was like, almost half a block. It was a huge, it was seconds. Yes.
So those people who die, well, it's karma?
I'm not going to speculate on that, because the thing is, no, and this is another story. The reason why I won't comment on that is because it's the duty of a devotee to be compassionate. And if we sit down and watch stupidity happen, oh, it's their karma. That's not what one of the 26 qualities of devotee is compassion. That's what we have the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada says we have the Bhagavad Gita because Arjuna was compassionate. He didn't want to kill a gazillion people in the battle of Kurukshetra. So the reason why devotees don't say, oh, it's his karma, you've got to deal with it, is, and this is the story, there was one, everyone knows I love soccer, but there was one prominent soccer coach who addressed this issue. There was something, it was in Europe, it was a prominent European soccer coach, and there was a soccer player who was paralyzed through a soccer injury. And he said, oh, it's because of karma. It's what he did in his past life. He has never had another soccer job. You can't say that. You can't say, oh, it's their karma. Leave karma alone. Karma works for its own reasons. As devotees, we are compassionate. We want to say, whatever your karma is, good or bad, what we want to do is we want to eliminate all of it. What we want to do is make sure for the sake of the philosophical discussion, yes, karma, everything that happens in the material nature is because of karma. Nothing, that's what makes the material world, that's the actually the fuel, pardon me, of the material world, karma. That's what makes material nature work, karma. We act, and that action adds to the cycle of karma. Karma makes everything happen. The only variable, is Krishna. So devotees, we don't say, oh, it's your karma. I mean, I know many friends I went to Gurukul with were sexually abused. And some devotees said, oh, it's their karma. That is, unacceptable for devotees to sit there and watch someone's karma play out. Devotees, the nature of a pure devotee is compassion. Prahlad Maharaj said that. Forget, I want to help all people. I want to help all in the cities, not just those in the towns and villages. I see their suffering, I want to help them. So philosophically, yes, karma runs everything in the material world. What we want to do is we see that they're suffering, and even if it is karma, Krishna is giving us the tools to negate karma. And that's what we're trying to share, to negate our own karma, and help others negate their karma by adding Krishna to it. Let's chant around.